Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, May 25th, 2016. The State Department's Inspector General says Hillary Clinton broke the rules with her private email server. Our opening music today from former Talking Heads member Jerry Harrison. And the song is called Man with a Gun, but the refrain in it is pretty girl, young girl, old man, man with a gun. The rules do not apply. And in the case of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, she was told repeatedly that it violated protocols and security rules for her to use a private server. But for her, the rules don't apply. And to this day, her campaign and her spinmeisters, despite this sharply critical report, they're saying, hey, nothing here. It's just another Republican scandal. It's like Benghazi. It's like Whitewater. You know, just move along. Don't pay any attention. Well, first, let's get to what the Inspector General actually reported. And the organization there conducted a serious review of the email practices of Hillary Clinton and her predecessors as Secretary of State. One of the interesting findings is that, in contrast to earlier reports, Colin Powell, who was the first Secretary of State in the George W. Bush administration, has acknowledged that he made widespread use of private email while he was Secretary of State. He blames the non-functional State Department email system that limited him to emailing people inside the State Department, and that's why he said he had to use an outside system. But he didn't set up a private server. He just used, a commercial account like Yahoo or Google or whatever was available at that time. So we're going to hear from the spinners of the Clinton story that, well, Secretary Powell did it, Hillary did it, there's no news here, there's no crime, there's no violation, just forget about it. Well, the Inspector General report said that Hillary Clinton had an obligation to discuss using her personal email account to conduct official business with the security folks there, but they found no evidence that she had. They found no evidence that she had requested or received approval from anyone at the department to conduct her state business on a personal email. And they said that she didn't seek permission and wouldn't have received it if she had. So, there were meetings that were held. They briefed her. The cybersecurity people at the State Department told her what the policies were. The report also indicates that a low-level State Department official, Scott Gratian, who was the ambassador to Kenya for just a year, from 2011 to 2012, that he was rebuked for using private email. They warned him that he wasn't authorized to be using personal email for government business. He continued doing so. The State Department initiated disciplinary action over his failure to follow these directions, and then he resigned before any discipline could be imposed. So that appears to be the best example of how Hillary Clinton was above the rules. The rules didn't apply to her. But when it came to a low-level ambassador to an African nation, that the rules did apply. And it is this double standard that troubles me about the overarching issue here of whether this violation disqualifies her to be President of the United States. And clearly there is a double standard, and this is something that the Clintons have believed that they're entitled to for a long, long time. Just look at the various scandals that they brushed off in the 1990s. And I also believe that there are serious issues about the contents of many of these emails, but that's kind of, been pushed into the background. I've told you about the troubling emails from Sid Blumenthal to Hillary Clinton, promoting business deals by Joe Wilson, the husband of Valerie Plame. Wilson got $65 million for his client from a State Department fund controlled by Hillary Clinton. And that kind of cronyism is deeply troubling. And then there's the email that exposed how she advocated military intervention in Syria, primarily in the interests of the state of Israel. And these are emails that should be widely discussed. And her opponent, Bernie Sanders, gave an interview today to, or yesterday, I think, to the Sacramento Bee. And he's been accused of running a scorched earth campaign against Hillary Clinton, which is a really bogus charge, in my opinion. But he told the reporter, look, I've been asked 5 million times about the emails, and I haven't said anything. I've been asked about the Clinton Foundation. Didn't say anything. Bill Clinton's personal life? Never said a word. And Sanders is correct that he withheld comment on some of these issues. Now, I don't need to hear him unload about Bill Clinton's personal life, but the Clinton Foundation, that is a very serious issue of grave concern, and it is the peddling of influence and money by a former president whose wife was Secretary of State. He was gathering funds from governments that benefited from arms sales agreements and others that crossed the desk of the Secretary of State. And that appearance of a conflict of interest is very serious to me, and I think it's a huge failure that Bernie Sanders held his fire. But it does buttress his contention that he hasn't run a scorched earth campaign. Now, meanwhile, a reliable blogger, I don't know if he's a reporter, he publishes at a website called Politics USA, Politicus USA. It's one of those websites that you have to say, gosh, David Brock, why did you pick that name for it? Anyway, the guy in question here is Jason Easley. I see his pro-Clinton reporting on a daily basis, and it's interesting. I've linked to his article. The headline is misleading. It reads, State Department deals a death blow to the Republican Party's Clinton email scandal. It's not a Republican Party scandal. It is Hillary Clinton's scandal. But this is an attempt to, you know, blame others, to make her a victim here. And what's interesting is when you get below the headline and get into the body of this article, the reporter admits a new State Department audit has found that Hillary Clinton and previous Republican secretaries of state, well, it's just one, poorly managed the use of email. The audit also blames the State Department itself for being slow to adopt its policies to changing technologies, and that is fair. But he goes on, the problem for Republicans is that the basis of their scandal is that Clinton did something different and more criminal than previous secretaries of state. See? It's the neener, they did it, so it's okay if I did it. And he just blows past the rest of this report. By the way, I've linked to the full report via Vice News, and you can read all or part of it as you wish. But this Spinmeister goes on to admit Clinton didn't handle her email well, but neither did previous Republican secretaries of state. Again, it's only one, Colin Powell. Condoleezza Rice, apparently never intentionally got State Department emails on a personal email account. And they're claiming in this spin that the real issue here is a huge waste of money by the Republicans. Again, there are substantive issues about the manner in which Hillary Clinton set up the email system, and it was primarily intended to avoid disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act, in my opinion. And so it is just amazing to see how far the spin is from the reality of the Inspector General's report. Elizabeth Warren appears to have taken on the job of being the appointed attacker on Donald Trump. And to the extent that she does this voluntarily, I don't have any real problem. But Elizabeth Warren went public yesterday with talking points against Trump that are precisely the talking points that came out of the campaign. And the reliable supporter of Hillary Clinton, Rachel Maddow, had Clinton's spokesman, Brian Fallon, on her show last night and was schmoozing up to him in a very obvious way. And he repeated these same issues that Rachel had reported on in the section before he came on. and that is that there are recordings of Donald Trump back in 2008 celebrating the Wall Street meltdown and the crash in housing prices, saying that, well, this was a great opportunity to buy more property. So here's a quote from Elizabeth Warren. Donald Trump was drooling over the idea of a housing meltdown because it meant he could buy up a bunch of more property on the cheap. What kind of man does that? Well, I'll tell you exactly what kind of man does that, answering her own question. It is a man who cares about no one but himself, a small, insecure money grubber who doesn't care who gets hurt so long as he makes a profit off it. Now, it's interesting because the New York Times report on Elizabeth Warren's attacks on Trump goes on to acknowledge her attacks echo those leveled by Hillary Clinton. And so it's clear that there is coordination between the Clinton campaign and Senator Warren. And she, of course, is well positioned to attack Trump over Wall Street issues and greed and that sort of thing. But where was Elizabeth Warren when Bernie Sanders really needed her endorsement? And it really undermines the respect I have for Senator Warren that she has played this loosey-goosey game during this critical presidential campaign. It is so clear that with the money that has compromised Hillary Clinton from the Wall Street speeches and her coziness with the bankers to begin with, that Bernie Sanders really represents the issues that matter most to Elizabeth Warren. But she played politics, withheld her support for Sanders, and now, while she has not explicitly endorsed Clinton, she is clearly a surrogate for the Hillary Clinton campaign. And Sanders is acknowledging that the convention in Philadelphia may be messy. And he said he condemns any and all forms of violence, but he pushed back on what happened in Las Vegas, saying that it didn't turn violent, as some media reports indicated. There was rowdyism. There was booing, I think inappropriately, by the way. But we know that no chair was thrown, and I wish Bernie would call out that lie. And Sanders is correct in saying, so what if the Democratic convention is messy? Democracy is messy. Every day my life is messy. He should say, look at my hair. But if you want everything to be quiet and orderly and allow, you know, just things to proceed without vigorous debate, that's not what democracy is about. Now, the New York Times reports today, and there's no linkage to John Oliver's powerful indictment of the primary process on his past Sunday night show on HBO, but there should be, because leaders of the Republican Party have begun internal deliberations about fundamental changes to the Republican primary process. And you might not like exactly what they're talking about, because the real tension is whether to make all of the primaries elections and closed to only Republican Party members, or to continue some of the caucuses and to open up the Republican Party to independent voters. Now, I think it's really interesting to see this debate start up. We need a similar debate on the Republican side, and clearly the superdelegate system and the arcane rules that vary from state to state need to be updated and made much more transparent. But both parties are going to run into the problem that the states control these primaries, and you cannot dictate from the party hierarchy how, for example, the state of Nevada conducts its process. They're going to try to move Nevada out of the early calendar date and try to balance that a little more, they say. But any attempts to change this are likely to limit Democratic participation and not expand it. That is my opinion. I want to share with you, you know, I don't watch very many commercials on television because I've got the DVR and I skip through them. But occasionally, as I'm zipping past at, 4X, I notice an ad that catches my attention. And last night on television, I can't remember where, I saw this really scurrilous ad. And it doesn't mention Senator Sanders, but on a recent visit to Puerto Rico, he deplored what the Congress is trying to do, continuing to deny bankruptcy relief to the American possession in the Caribbean that is deeply in debt, and it is really foundering as a result. So I'm going to play the audio track for this ad, which was produced by the Center for Individual Freedom, which is a pro-gun, pro-tobacco, anti-climate change organization run by a longtime Republican bagman from Virginia. And this is a really misleading ad about, number one, the problems in Puerto Rico. And they're basically making the case that taxpayers all across the United States who had nothing to do with running up the debt in Puerto Rico are going to foot the bill, when in fact this is an argument to allow the predatory bondholders who bought up all of Puerto Rico's debt in order to squeeze this island even further. That's who really is protected by the message of this commercial, not seniors and savers, as they argue.
After years of reckless spending, Puerto Rico is out of money. Now savers and seniors could pay the price. Why should you care? Because Puerto Rico is just the start. The Obama administration wants to set a precedent. High-spending states like Illinois, New Jersey, California owe trillions in debt. When these states can't afford to pay, you could be stuck with the bill. Puerto Rico is just the first domino to fall. Tell Congress, no super Chapter 9 bankruptcy for Puerto Rico.
So the final sentence there is very clear. They want to block Chapter 9 bankruptcy for Puerto Rico. And it's not because of seniors or savers. And the misleading comments about the debt in Illinois and California and New Jersey, it relates to pension obligations. And they are underwater. It's an issue that needs to be addressed. But these are not current liabilities. They are not pending or due to be collected anytime soon. But that is the misleading case that is being made in a very dangerous commercial message there. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. On my list today, well, we've got a number of people, including Benny Alto, Roger Barr, who just renewed his annual subscription. Thank you, Roger. And Andy Krieger over here, too. I want to thank each of you. Please, if you're not a subscriber, consider joining their ranks. It's easy. You come to peterbcollins.com, click menu, then click become a subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and from there, it's a breeze. If you want to take out a new $50 annual subscription and give me a mailing address in the continental U.S., well, I'd be delighted to send you a bonus book, and the bonus books are listed on the sign-up page at peterbcollins.com. And I just clicked on to Kickstarter.com to the NewsBud crowdfunding campaign, and I was hoping to see six figures today, but we're just about $2,400 shy. We're at $98,631 toward our $150,000 goal. And over the long Memorial Day weekend and break, I hope you'll take a moment to go to NewsBud.com, click on that video and watch it. Review our business plan, and share that information on your networks, in social media, via email, maybe to friends at that barbecue on Memorial Day. I'd really appreciate it because we are gearing up. Later today, the video cameraman, Tom McAfee, is coming in to set up. And tomorrow we're going to be recording some of our first interviews and kind of a trial run for the video news report that I'm going to anchor every week at newsbud.com. I'm very excited about this, and I think it's going to be an excellent addition to the work that I do, and I think it's going to reach a bigger audience. So that's why I'm in for NewsBud, and I hope you'll get in as well. Yesterday I reported about Bill McKibben and Steve Horn's exposés about how Exxon and Mobil have known since the 1960s ways to reduce carbon emissions from systems, including automobiles, that are fueled by oil-based products. And we're learning a little bit more, and today is the day that Exxon Mobil holds its annual meeting. Once again, the shareholder resolutions will be voted down, but there are 17 state attorneys general who are investigating ExxonMobil for misleading the public about climate change. And The Guardian reports today new information that during the George W. Bush administration, they barely waited until Bush had gotten into office, the 29th of January. That's 9 days after Bush is inaugurated. A former senior environmental advisor at Exxon named Arthur Randall, He phoned up Nikki Sunt, communications director for a research program that had been presenting seminars for Congress about climate change and climate science. And the order came down from Exxon that it's over. We're not going to hold any more of these forums. And the same guy, Arthur Randall, went on to cherry-pick individuals and get them bounced from government by the compliant Bush officials. On the 6th of February, Randall wrote a memo urging the Bush administration to demand the removal of Bob Watson, a well-regarded climate scientist from the UN science climate science panel. And because he'd been handpicked by Al Gore, they did remove him. And Randall also recommended the sacking of three other U.S. climate officials. Well, I've been reporting to you that the Netanyahu government has become even more extreme with the addition of Avigdor Lieberman as the defense minister. And I've reported to you that this stems from the remarkable and ugly pandering to the public about the events from March, where an Israeli soldier in cold blood killed a wounded Palestinian who was lying on the ground. And Lieberman has pandered to that same group of the public in Israel, and that appears to be the main reason that Netanyahu sacked the defense minister Yalon last week and replaced him with this nut job. And so he's a very aggressive guy, and he told an audience about a month ago, not knowing that he would become defense minister, he said, "If I were defense minister, I would give the leader of Hamas 48 hours. And then you are dead." So he is very arrogant, very aggressive, and doesn't really care about what people think. Regarding the case of the soldier, Ilor Azaria, who shot and killed the Palestinian man I mentioned, Lieberman said, "I hope that at the end of the process, the soldier will be acquitted, and it will be clear to everybody that it is the right of every Jew, and especially of a soldier, to protect himself from a terrorist who has come to kill him." Now, this, once again, spins the idea of self-defense into territory that defies definition. And so they're claiming that this soldier was defending Israel with the cold-blooded murder of an unarmed, wounded Palestinian who was lying on the ground. Now, he was a suspect of knifing an Israeli soldier, but that does not justify it in any way, shape, or form. So the New York Times today offered a news report and then an opinion piece from Tom Friedman, who had to take a swipe in his opening paragraph at the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. He writes, "Israel has recently been under intense criticism on the world stage. Some of it, like the BDS campaign, is a campus movement to destroy Israel, masquerading as a political critique." Now, this is highly offensive that Tom Friedman, who knows better, describes the effort of people to change the behavior of the extreme Zionist government of Israel in its apartheid approach to some of its own citizens and the way it treats the Palestinians, that those of us who support BDS want to destroy Israel. That is a flat-out lie. Most of the people who care enough to support BDS want to save Israel from itself. And that's the thought that Friedman goes to next. Immediately after he slams BDS, he says, "A lot of it is also driven by Israel's desire to destroy itself. Thanks to Netanyahu's steady elimination of any possibility that Israel will separate itself from the Palestinians in the West Bank." He goes on to say that this could lead to a binational state controlled by Jewish extremists, and that we may soon be referring to Netanyahu as the Prime Minister of the State of Israel, Palestine. He says that things under Netanyahu have gone from bad to worse, and that replacing Yalon with Lieberman is, let's see. He says the man who boasts that he couldn't care less about what American Jews think about how Israel is behaving, and a man who is dismissed by Netanyahu's team as a petty prattler, unfit to be even a military analyst, and whose closest brush with a real battle was dodging a tennis ball. So I will link to Friedman's piece here, because he does make some sense, recognizing that Netanyahu has gone too far again. And he closes by saying that this, for those of us who care about Israel's future, this is a dark hour. Well, it is. And claiming that BDS would destroy Israel does not advance your argument, Mr. Friedman. A new poll shows that 95.5% of Palestinians believe that their leadership under Mahmoud Abbas is corrupt. And sadly, they're probably right. There is a powerful piece published today at Alternet, and it's under the byline of Rob Bryan. And I think that this is a blockbuster story that Max Blumenthal has been working on, but he doesn't get any credit for the article that was published today. I'll be in touch with Max to get more information. But I am linking to this lengthy article because it exposes the American Zionist activist, a man who calls himself America's rabbi and uses the name Shmuley Botiash or Botesh. The last name I would pronounce phonetically Botich, and his legal name is Botak, and I'm not sure why he uses the different name publicly. But this guy is a real operator, and he is a slasher when it comes to his idea of protecting the interests of the state of Israel. He wrote a book called Kosher Sex. He cozied up to Michael Jackson. He has a real sordid history with a reality TV show called Shalom in the Home. He was a longtime ally of U.S. Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey, who now is on the outs with Botiash. And it's a fascinating look at how he has cozied up to powerful and wealthy supporters of the State of Israel, most notably Sheldon Adelson, and is now in tight with the family of Donald Trump. Because Shmuley writes for the New York Observer, a weekly newspaper that is owned by Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. That's the guy married to Ivanka Trump. And Jared Kushner's father is a wealthy real estate developer and convicted felon who has contributed to Botich's nonprofit, which is called the World Values Network. Now, the disclosures here are fascinating. The World Values Network has published a series of really scurrilous full-page ads in the New York Times that cost about $100,000 each. And some of them are really virulent in the way they attack people like Sidney Blumenthal and Max, his son, who is the journalist who's written powerful books that are critical of Israel, notably Goliath and the 51-Day War. And so this is a very important expose of the back channels that Shmuley Botesh operates with, the influence that he is able to acquire, the nonprofit that he runs that primarily is used to fund him and an expensive lifestyle. He tried to convert his home in New Jersey to a temple or a synagogue by pretending to hold services there as a way to reduce his tax bill. He also ran for Congress, and when he did, Sheldon Adelson kicked in $500,000. You're only allowed to contribute $2,700 as an individual, but, you know, they use super PACs to get around the campaign contribution limits, and that appears to be the case when Shmuley ran for Congress unsuccessfully. There is more to the story, and I encourage you to read it. I am going to track down Max Blumenthal and the reporter who wrote this, Rob Bryan, and see if we can get a full in-depth interview about this topic coming up soon. President Obama is in Asia, and he left Vietnam today after lecturing the Vietnamese on human rights. Now, it's fair. The human rights situation in Vietnam is problematic. There's still an authoritarian government there, and there were people who were barred from meeting President Obama because they are dissidents. But we've got to step back and reflect. If you were Vietnamese and you heard an American president, let's be fair, Obama wasn't even born before the Vietnam War was well underway. So he's not responsible for some of that legacy. But still, he's got to recognize that as an American, lecturing the Vietnamese on human rights after the massive and obscene violations that we committed there in the 1960s, well, I don't think it's a terribly effective messenger. Maybe a good message, but not the right messenger. Now the president is in Japan. He began with apologies for a murder and rape case on the island of Okinawa that is being pinned on an American service member, a guy who worked at the airbase there. And I'm glad that he is apologizing and recognizing the painful relationship that we've had with the Japanese, particularly in Okinawa, over the years. And on Friday, the president goes to Hiroshima. And we've already been told that he's not going to apologize for the atomic bomb that we dropped there on August 8, 1945. But more than 70 scholars and activists, led by David Swanson, have signed on to a letter urging the president to reconsider, urging him to meet with A-bomb survivors, known in Japanese as hibakusha, and to make a formal announcement that he is going to end the U.S. plans to spend $1 trillion for the next generation of nuclear weapons, that he will reduce the deployed U.S. arsenal from somewhere north of 8,000 to 1,000 nuclear weapons or less, and call on Russia to join the United States in convening good faith negotiations under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Well, good news. The United States is reducing its addiction to tobacco products. A new survey shows that the rate of smoking among adults fell to 15% last year, and that is significant progress. And finally today, some reaction from listener Colleen McGuire to my comments yesterday about the TSA, the long lines, the sacking of the TSA guy in charge of airport security. And she writes, "Peter, on Tuesday's show, you reported that airline screening makes for longer lines, people missing flights, etc. You ultimately attributed this to TSA policy and procedures, taking off shoes, that sort of stuff. However, the New York Times reported May 5th that TSA procedures are only part of the problem. A combination of fewer screeners, tighter budgets, new checkpoint procedures, and growing numbers of passengers is already creating a mess." Well, my point, Colleen, is not about those particulars. It's that the whole scene is ridiculous. It is ineffective. The failure rate, as you know, is at 95% of when they test the screeners to find a fake bomb. And I'm tired of the whole process of airport security theater. Colleen also notes that USA Today reported that airlines have reported record profits, but she says, "I guess none of that money is going to TSA screeners." Well, the deal after 9/11, because the airlines were hurt so badly, was, well, the U.S. government will pay for screeners that the airlines used to pay. And so we're on the hook for that now, and I don't expect the airlines are going to say, "Well, we're profitable now, we'll take back control of that." But my fundamental point is that this is an empty process that does not make us safe. It is simply used to try to, in my opinion, insert fear into the American public and pretend that we are keeping people safe when everybody knows it is a charade. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. You're free to share this podcast with absolutely everyone. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.